Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, February 5th, 2018. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 73-year-old monthly political probity, intellectual analysis, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. I cannot speak today. Join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. Sadly, Noah Rothman is out today with the flu, but with me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Saurabh Amari, our senior writer. Hi, Saurabh.
Hi, John.
Guys, we had a weekend of the Nunes memo. Nobody knows how to pronounce the man's name. Head of the House Intelligence Committee, of course, looking into the question of the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant, investigating former Trump campaign official Carter Page, and whether or not the warrant was untoward and calls into question the validity of the probes into Trump and the question of Russian collusion or conspiracy or whatever. Okay. So, Saurabh Amari, you have delved, you've drunk deep of these waters, swum into them, delved into them.
There's
delving and sleeping and swimming and whatever. And you, I believe, have come up with the, you do not believe that this is, as everybody who doesn't like the memo says, that it was a nothing burger. You think it was rather a
something burger.
A something burger. So we are now introducing Commentary Magazine podcast is introducing into the dialogue and the discussion of the memo controversy the term something burger.
I have to say, I have to give credit where it's due. It's Kyle Smith tweeted it.
Kyle Smith of National Review, whom I actually ran into on the street today. We live a block away from each other. Talked about Edward Albee, but he came up with the term something burger. That's so right. Let us discuss why you believe it is a something burger and not a nothing burger.
So let me stipulate a few things before going on. I believe, A, that Carter Page was an obvious kind of Putin apologist. You needn't delve into any sort of secret record. It was in the public record that this guy is one of those people on the American right who's fascinated and has unseemly views when it comes to Russia. I will also stipulate that Trump himself has unseemly views about Vladimir Putin. He's very loath to criticize the Russian dictator. He surrounded himself in his early campaign with various people who had shady ties, not least Paul Manafort, to kind of the Kremlin orbit. All that is being stipulated. I will also say that I don't believe that Trump was a victim of a deep state conspiracy, like an active conspiracy. Nevertheless, having stipulated all of that, I think that something untoward happened that the memo has captured, and that it should be taken seriously and not dismissed as a nothing burger or something for morons to ponder, and that there's nothing to it. Having said all of that, and the reason that I think it's important is because it captures a pattern of politicized law enforcement. And the way I analogize it is it's not, McCabe and Bruce Orr and these other FBI agents all sitting around in a smoke-filled room, you know, tapping their fingers together and saying, how can we sink Trump? But the kind of politicization, you know, that Israel faces when it's discussed as this at the State Department, where it's part of the air that some people breathe, is a sort of Arabist attitude. Same thing here, where it didn't raise eyebrows. If the memo is to be believed, it didn't raise eyebrows when Bruce Orr neglected or declined to identify explicitly, not just that the memo had a, or not that the Steele dossier had a partisan provenance, but that he, that it specifically was paid for by the DNC.
I never know how much to have to go back and explain in this case, because we're so into the weeds on these things. But so maybe we should sort of annotate this a little bit.
Okay, Bruce Orr.
Okay, so to annotate this, the Steele memo is the dossier compiled by the former British MI6 agent who was hired by the investigative firm Fusion GPS, working for a cutout of the Hillary campaign and the DNC to investigate Trump's ties to Russia.
Correct. Okay?
This is the dossier that features the what James Comey called the salacious and unverified allegations about Donald Trump in Moscow in 2013 and hookers and various unseemly sexual acts. That is what Comey said was salacious and unverified, not the rest of the memo.
Correct.
Okay, so that's the Steele memo. The question that is raised by the Nunes memo about the Steele dossier is, was it the sole or primary reason that this warrant was taken out against the former Trump campaign official Carter Page? And what evidence we have so far suggests that it was, because former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe apparently told ranking or second member Nunes' colleague Trey Gowdy that it was the reason that
the warrant was
the
sought.
Warrant was sought, not that it was granted by the judge, but that it was sought. So we were told that that was, it was the reason. That's number one, right? Number two is that Bruce Orr, a high-ranking Justice Department official whose wife, as it happens, worked for the intelligence gathering firm Fusion GPS, kind of acknowledged the same thing. And then we are since learned that even though Steele was cut off from the FBI because he went to the press and talked to Mike Isikoff of Yahoo and to David Korn of The Nation, that his information was still being fed through Bruce Orr's wife to Bruce Orr and therefore to the Justice Department. So when we use the terms like McCabe and Steele dossier, that's what we're talking about. Again, I figure most of the people who are listening to this kind of know a lot of this already, but,
no, but
I
have to annotate.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So I think the most damning allegation in the memo is that the one that stood out to me, which is why I said that is a devastating fact, unless there's more information about it or it turns out to be untrue, which I mentioned that caveat, but it was the fact that Bruce Orr's wife worked for Fusion GPS, that Steele, the spy, the British spy, had repeatedly made statements suggesting that he thinks that Trump has to be stopped at any cost, that he's a danger to the American way or what have you, and that, as the memo puts it, that they declined to provide the judges who would grant the essentially the warrant to surveil Page with that information, and that even after Steele was terminated as an FBI informant because he went to the press, specifically to Yahoo News, and spoke about his activities and his quote-unquote findings, the information continued to be funneled essentially to the Justice Department via Bruce Orr's wife. And if that were the only kind of instance of potential FBI malfeasance, maybe it would be nothing. But you have to take it in a sort of totality of facts and circumstances. And you add the fact that there were those inappropriate texts. Yes, they were maybe taken out of context, out of thousands of texts between
Now we're talking about the text between
FBI
Justice
agent.
Department official Lisa Page and FBI official Peter Strzok.
Seem to mock Trump.
To be fair, okay, so these texts were part of the thing where it made people who seemed to be skeptical that Nunes was onto something a couple of weeks ago, ooh, this doesn't look good. Like, these texts are terrible. Peter Strzok making fun of Trump to his girlfriend Lisa Page having an extramarital affair with, and when Robert Mueller found out about it, Strzok was working for it, he kicked him off the investigation. Okay, so however, the Wall Street Journal got through some FOIA request 50,000 texts or something between Strzok and his girlfriend, and said that there was almost nothing there about that revealed that this was not a major subject between them, since most of the major discussion between them was
about other
pillow
things.
Talk, right? So
then you add the fact that Andrew McCabe,
Deputy FBI director, who was just kind of demoted, is now retiring,
and he's married to a Democratic partisan in Virginia, who happens to have received a lot of money from Clinton bundler Terry McAuliffe. And a few other facts of the kind, and you put that together and you say it's not a conspiracy, and it's no reason, as Paul Ryan, as Trey Gowdy and others have emphasized, it's no reason, it has nothing to do with the Mueller probe, which should continue to go on, but there is reason to be uncomfortable about some of the behavior that's disclosed between how the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant was sought for Page, the callous partisanship of some of the FBI and Justice Department officials, that deserves to be looked at. And if it means that Mueller will be more circumspect, more careful, more reluctant to hire people who are essentially Democratic donors and maxed out as Democratic donors, and be that much more scrupulous, because this is not, as some people have said, look, you know, all sorts of information is fed to judges when a probable warrant, probable cause determination is made, right? So this investigative reporter Brad Heath, I think, pointed out an example of a police officer who went to a judge for probable cause about a woman with marijuana plants in her apartment. What he didn't tell the judge was that he was her father-in-law, and they were involved in a terrible family squabble. So it's like, well, you know, any sort of information can be brought forward. The difference is that you're not dealing with a Chicago marijuana bust here. This is the most sensitive, the most politicized investigation possibly in the history of the United States, or certainly in the 21st century. And therefore, every actor has to be extremely careful about avoiding
the appearance. So this, of course, is the Caesar's wife point, that what happened in the case of Peter Strzok, the FBI agent, was that when we first heard about it, it was like, oh my God, Mueller has, you know, got this guy next to him, and this is really dangerous, and he should know better, because this investigation needs to be so above any kind of suspicion for it to have the effect that it wanted. Now, then it turned out that he had actually fired Strzok 5 months earlier, before we'd even found out about this, which meant that there was a couple of days of speculation that Mueller had been sloppy, which apparently is not true. The minute that it came known to him that this was the case, basically this guy's career is ruined because of this. So, so Abe, Sorab has now declared this a something burger. I think you agree that it's a something burger. But someone that Noah's not here to do the devil's advocate line about how it's a nothing burger or whatever. So I'm not going to ask you to do that. But I do think, can you punch any holes, let's say, in Sorab's narrative here?
Well, I think while I do agree entirely with Sorab, I think the one detail of the memo that a lot of people latched onto as sort of maybe even blowing up the very purpose of the memo, the sort of Trump defense aspect of the memo, comes toward the end, where the memo talks about how, in fact, there was already, prior to the Steele dossier, an FBI investigation into Carter Page.
That's one detail. The other detail was that there was already an investigation into the Trump campaign,
right?
Because George Papadopoulos, another one of these guys who was listed as a Trump foreign policy advisor in this March document that they ginned up because they needed to show that they had somebody in the Republican ambit who was a foreign policy expert who supported Trump, that George Papadopoulos had been overheard bragging that the Russians were handing information to the Trump campaign about Hillary Clinton, overheard in London by the Australian ambassador, who told the head of the Australian CIA, who told the head of our CIA, who told the FBI, and that long before anything happened with this FISA warrant and Carter Page, the FBI was already looking into the Trump campaign based on information from a foreign source, friendly foreign source, who overheard it in London. So that, I think, was the detail that supposedly blew up the rest of the right. The rest of the memo,
especially because that bit of news was actually already sort of reported by the New York Times, but Trump defenders pushed back against it, denied it,
right?
And now this seems to confirm it does confirm the New York Times scoop. So there is that. There's also there's some sort of McCabe denial, right? It was reported that after the memo came out, I think I first saw it somewhere on the Daily Beast or maybe CNN. They said that McCabe said that no, in fact, the Steele dossier was not the sort of tipping point for there being a FISA request.
Right. So, however, that's a claim, and right. We don't know, right? And so we can go into the tertiary parsing of all this that the FBI's complaint against the release of the Nunes memo was that it had material omissions of fact and that this was damaging to the FBI. A lot of other people have then looked at the memo. We all read the memo and said, wait a minute, what on earth here could be considered any form of a breach of national security or a threat to national security? These investigators should not be making wild claims like this thing harms national security. And then when it comes out, it doesn't seem to do that, because what are we going to do the next time they say you can't release something because it harms national security? We have reason now to be skeptical that this is simply just a way of trying to prevent information that they don't want to come out, which is not the way things are supposed to work. You're not supposed to use... you're not supposed to use national security as a cover to, cover up something that you find humiliating or embarrassing. Supposedly, the Democratic counter memo that hasn't been released goes into detail about why, yes, it is a breach of national security, and da-da-da-da. Benjamin Wittes of Lawfare blog this morning says that simply by naming a target of a FISA warrant and the names of people involved in the issuing of a FISA warrant or the search for a FISA warrant, that has never happened before, and that is a threat to national security. Now, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Just because something has never happened before doesn't mean that it's happening now is such a material change that it threatens national security. So there's that issue. So was the attack on it disingenuous? The memo comes out. Even the people who say that it's a nothing burger, therefore, are harming their own case, because if it's a nothing burger, then it didn't threaten national security. So this 2 weeks of, crazed, pushback against the evil horror of the Nunes memo was just disingenuous partisanship, right? Okay, now I'm going to push back against the Sorab case, but maybe before I push back against the Sorab case, we should discuss man crates. Let me tell you about man crates. So look, are you giving your guy a box of chocolates for Valentine's Day? So boring. Surprise him with a heart-shaped box of delicious beef jerky, the ultimate... I gotta say it because it's here on the snack aphrodisiac. So I'm introducing mancrates.com. You heard about it last week on this show. The only place to find awesome gifts guys love. This isn't some cologne sampler or cheesy mung. Mancrates offers curated gift collections for every type of guy, from the sports fanatic to the home chef to the outdoorsman. Check out classics like the NFL barware crate and the whiskey appreciation crate, or fresh takes on traditional Valentine's gifts like the jerky heart or the salami bouquet. Go to mancrates.com, pick the perfect gift, then wait for that magic moment. He'll fall head over heels when his gift arrives and he gets to pry the wooden crate open with the included crowbar. They have thousands of five-star reviews. Every gift comes with a complete satisfaction guarantee. So, my friend, Abe Greenwald, you have received a man crate.
I have the Caffeine Fiend Man Crate.
The Caffeine Fiend Man Crate. What was in it?
You have some beautiful artisanal coffee beans. You have a high-tech, beautiful grinder for the beans, a travel mug. Fantastic. I got to sample the coffee over the weekend. It was lovely.
Okay, what about opening the crate with the crowbar?
Opening the crate is in keeping with the man crate theme. It provides a good manly challenge. It's a big wooden box with seeming way in. And Abe, even I got it done.
Would you describe yourself as a kind of outdoorsy person who often takes a crowbar and opens things with a crowbar?
Baby steps. This was the first one.
Okay, this is very important. Abe, like me, Abe, I think, is best described as an indoorsman. Would that be correct?
Yes, okay, the great indoors.
Yeah, the great indoors. Abe, there was a point at which Abe couldn't even figure out how to set his voice message on the phone system here. That's how, I would say, competent he is in some of these. Right? Would you? That would be fair.
We're still in that point.
We're still in that point. Okay. So the point is that Abe got the man crate, and it made him feel just a little manlier. Is that right?
You bet.
So that's why you want to go to man.
I'll let you feel my callus later.
You want to go to mancrates.com/commentary for 5% off. They don't offer a discount anywhere else. Get 5% off right now at mancrates.com/commentary. Mancrates.com/commentary. So, very manly. We're all very manly here at the table. So I'm now going to push back in a manly fashion against Sorab. I'm not trying to think of what it is, because I also think it's a something. I think that there are, I'm now going to stipulate the opposite of what Sorab did, which is I'm going to stipulate that I believe that stuff may have happened pretty much after the election that suggests untoward behavior by elements of the more political side of the Obama administration, where they were so horrified by the results of the election and believed that the nation was at risk from Trump that they may have suspended some of their more prudent understandings of the role of government and the powers of the executive branch, and fumfered around in ways that they should not have fumfered around, particularly in the unmasking of people, meaning that foreign surveillance with conversations with Americans, we then discovered who the Americans were because those names were leaked out, and that is a terrible breach. Similarly, if in fact the pursuit of the FISA warrant against Carter Page was based on one piece of partisanly gleaned information and was not in fact the result of a sustained and careful, document 30 to 100 pages in length, which is what they're seemed to supposed to be, that can be as long as possible, and it didn't include all this information that we've heard about how dangerous Carter Page might have seemed to people from 2013 onward, that is very troubling. Similarly, if there was, talk about omissions of fact, if it turns out that there were omissions of fact from the FISA judge who had to agree to the warrant, if he wasn't told of the provenance of the memo or was told in a fashion so indirect in a footnote that he might not have even seen it or really paid that much attention to it, then why it was necessary to play that game, it suggests bad faith. It suggests that the document was produced in bad faith in an effort to hide information, and that is very disturbing because there's no, in a pursuit of a warrant, no one has the right to counsel. Like, you don't have the right to argue against it or something like that. And these warrants are very intrusive. That's why you have to have probable cause that someone was an agent of a foreign power to make it possible for you to intrude, go back, read their emails for 5 years and, you know, and surveil them directly through. We're talking about, you know, phone taps, searching their homes, all of that stuff, which can be done in secret without their knowledge. That's the whole point of this. And so it is a matter of concern, civil liberties concern to all of us, if that was mishandled. Okay, but the pushback would be this, which is Carter Page was somebody who was wandering around the planet looking for all intents and purposes like somebody who wanted to be a Russian agent. He got himself on this document at, you know, on the Trump campaign and suddenly gets an invitation to speak at a commencement address at a college in Russia, goes to Russia, meets with senior Russian officials, including, you know, ones at someone at a Putin-linked oil company and a leading figure in the foreign ministry, and of course was cashiered from the Trump campaign because stories came out about this behavior, and they said, "Ooh, we got to get the hell away from this guy. He's bad news." Around the same time that Manafort was cashiered, really in part for the same reason, right? So the pushback, and the other form of the pushback would be, like, spare me your crocodile tears about the violation of Carter Page's civil liberties. As many people have said, 12 people on the committee who voted for the release of the Nunes memo also signed, you know, and the Nunes memo and all this talk about how the horrors of the misuse of the FISA process, every single one of them voted to extend the FISA warrant process 3 weeks ago. So they're having been involved in this process, hearing about the dangers and horrors of the misuse of the FISA court, not a single one of them, you know, said we better have hearings into this or we got to do X, Y, and Z. They just voted for it.
By the way, also the extension, the excuse me, the each 90-day extension of the FISA warrant also is supposed to be based on their
new information. Yeah, new information. Right.
So that gives some credence to there being a there.
So again, to spell this out, the Carter Page FISA warrant was extended 3 times. In every 90 days, you have to extend the warrant, and the governing regs say the warrant has to be issued on the basis that the information gleaned in the previous 90 days was sufficient to continue the warrant. Now, for all we know, all of these regs and rules and things that are written down are observed almost entirely in the breach, right? That is to say, you want a FISA warrant, you get a FISA warrant. It used to be said that a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich. You want a search warrant, you'll find a judge who gets you a search warrant. You want a FISA warrant, some judge will give you a FISA warrant. We know that in, like, from 2001 to 2013, something like a total of 21 FISA warrants were denied by a court, as opposed to, say, thousands that were authorized. But that in 2016, 32 or 33 alone were denied. We don't know what they were. We don't know why they were denied. But it appears that the courts, the judges who serve in this process, got a little more skeptical about it than they had been in the previous decade, right? So, the pushback would be that all this nonsense about how the memo shouldn't be released—that was nonsense—but that this attack on the very idea that the notion that this memo means or any problems with it mean that the investigation into Trump is invalidated is preposterous. Trump is the reason that we have an independent counsel investigation into Trump. If Donald Trump had kept his mouth shut and hadn't said to James Comey, "Go easy on Michael Flynn," okay, if he hadn't done that, if he hadn't said, "I require your loyalty," if he hadn't taken him aside, you know, and treated him like, you know, he was Tom Hagen, this wouldn't have happened. This is on him. He did this to himself, number one. Rod Rosenstein didn't do it to him, and Comey didn't do it to him. Comey came out with the all the talk. Comey released the stuff about his behavior with Comey because Trump said, I have tapes of Comey. He better watch out because I'm going to show that he did something wrong, and that's why I fired him. And so Comey went to his friend at the Columbia Law School and basically gave him his own notes on what happened at those meetings as a form of self-protection. He was being slandered by the president of the United States. Now, I'm not a fan of Comey's. I wrote a piece the day that he was fired saying he should have been fired. He should have been fired on July 5th, 2016, when he failed to indict Hillary, not for failing to indict Hillary, but for issuing that state. If he wasn't going to indict Hillary, he could have announced we're not indicting Hillary and then closed up shop and gone away. Issuing a statement in which he said, I could have indicted her, but I didn't, was an act of total malfeasance on his part. He shouldn't have been serving as FBI director.
And all his grandstanding during the early years of the war on terror, which people forget.
Right, but I mean, look, I don't like him for that. Right.
Libby.
Yeah, I don't like him for that, but I'm saying I think mainly he actually behaved in a fashion that deserve firing in 2016. He did involve himself materially in a matter of of the national election in a way that was very ambiguous and untoward, and kept alive a story that, according to him, should have been dead. Or he either should have indicted her, or he shouldn't have indicted her. But he shouldn't have not indicted her with this giant shadow over the indictment, which of course then led to the reopening of the investigation, which then led to Hillary's defeat. So I'm no Comey fan, but Trump is responsible for what has happened to Trump, nobody else. And this notion that, you know, he is being, you know, pursued illegitimately is a notion that is helpful to Republicans who want to defend him. It is not helpful to the rule of law. It is not helpful to the good working order of the country, and is, I think, you know, highly problematic.
May I just enter here? I take all your points, and I'm not going to do pushback to your pushback, though I hate that phrase. But to make a point about the big actor in all of this, which is Devin Nunes. And the way that he's been portrayed as merely a tool of the Trump administration, it'll delve into the kind of a theme of institutional power. But do you guys know what Devin Nunes is? One of his main legislative obsessions has been for years before any of. It's the fact that there's an island, the Azores, these Portuguese islands in the middle of the Atlantic, where the U.S. has a military base, and which. As part of President Obama's dismantling of various bases, which, you know, rightly or wrongly, whatever the merits, they think that they weren't useful anymore and is not worth the cost of maintaining them. That was one of the bases that was designated for closure. And Devin Nunes has spent years attempting to change the Department of Defense's mind about this. And he has come to believe, and, you know, over, you know, a very long time, he's accumulated a lot of evidence that suggests that even under the guidelines that were set forth for which bases should remain open, the very top leadership of the DOD and the executive branch, essentially, and even the military brass have used, you know, incorrect information or have tried to mislead Congress and his own committee and others as to why they're closing this base. In other words, he has this sense that left on their own, administrative agencies, law enforcement agencies, the Pentagon and others, not out of malice but out of bureaucratic interest, will attempt to railroad Congress and its right to oversee agencies. I don't know how much this plays into that. But I think it's a fascinating perspective that that's his mindset. Right.
Okay, so that gets to this point, which is, again, that I gotta go at Trump for, which is that Trump is using the fact that there is an investigation into him and that Democrats are attacking him on the Hill and that the media are attacking him for what's going on with Russia and making certain mountains out of molehills, which I agree with, to say that there is a conspiracy, deep state conspiracy against him that has turned the FBI and the Justice Department and the CIA into tools of a conspiracy, and that they are, he is invalidating them on these grounds. Now, this, I think, is horrifying, not because there could be senior leadership at DOJ and even at the FBI and maybe even at the CIA who might be hostile to him and playing games against him, but that there are thousands of people under them, thousands, tens of thousands of people under them working every day whose agencies are coming under attack by their boss, by the head of the executive branch. And it's one thing, and it is fine to say that a Republican, an incoming Republican administration that might be getting the shaft and the runaround from surviving Democratic officials who stay there, you know, for the transition period and beyond, that those officials cannot be trusted, that they are working to undermine. We've actually, we know this happened because it happened at the Consumer Product Safety Testing Magic Commission, the name of which I can never remember, where, you know, there was an innate, you know, game going on to try to create the conditions under which the agency would name its own successor so that Richard Cordray, the guy who was running it, could run for a senator for governor in Ohio. So it's one thing to say there's this thing called the Trahison de Clercq, the sort of the permanent bureaucracy's war against the politicians. That's fine, but Trump's vulgarity and hostility and essentially antinomianism, because he doesn't like anybody, he doesn't like regulatory agencies that bothered him and his business, and he doesn't like the gaming commission in New Jersey, and he doesn't like all these people because they're mean, and, you know, when he built a hotel in Vegas, he wasn't allowed to have a casino in it and stuff like that. So he now just, you know, adapts these ideas to the bureaucracy that he himself heads, and it's disgusting. He is invalidating the work of people who are, like, trying to keep America safe. It's disgusting.
And because, John, as you said in your post last week about this, this is political war. This is war 21st century style. It's political war. All on his side below him and everyone who supports him, you know, with few exceptions, but huge swaths of the Trump support universe now also speak of this and view this and scream about this in terms of a deep state conspiracy. It's not about the more nuanced and serious question about, you know, sort of bureaucratic inertia and bureaucratic interests and whatnot.
Right. So I think that's really, you know, an interesting problem. And now I want to turn, as we close, to a fascinating article that just came out today by two guys, Jonathan Rauch and Ben Wittes, whom I mentioned earlier, who in The Atlantic, called Boycott the Republican Party. So Rauch and Wittes present themselves, and largely fairly, as totally nonpartisan people. So Rauch is a very Burkean, he's sort of a combination of a Burkean and a libertarian, if such a thing is possible, believes in, wrote a very good book called, now I can't remember the name of it, it's like Demosclerosis, about how the permanent bureaucracy in Washington retards the possibility of reform. Wittes is somebody who, in the realm of national security, as a professor, has been an advocate on the sort of nominal democratic side for enhanced powers of interrogation and, you know, and oversight, not oversight, but, you know, sort of surveillance and stuff like that. And they say that the Republican Party has now gone so far into serving as a cat's paw and protectorate for Trump, who is violating all sorts of norms, that it is necessary for people to, and I'm now trying to find the actual phrase, mindlessly oppose everything the Republican Party does. Vote for Democrats no matter what, even if you don't agree with anything that they say, because Trump, the assaults of Trump, were they to be normalized, would pose existential, not incidental, threats to American democracy. So their claim is that you just have to vote you just vote against Republicans no matter where you are, no matter, under all circumstances, because mindless opposition is what's necessary now. Quote, that is why we are rising above our independent predilections and behaving like dumbass partisans. It's why we hope many smart people will do the same. That is how they conclude the article. Okay, so
I have thoughts.
Abe, your thoughts.
Having read their piece, I think superficially it's they make a sort of kind of strong case against Trump and his violation of important norms having to do with the rule of law. On a deeper level, which not even that much deeper, it's exposed as, I think, hysterical nonsense and dangerous nonsense too. Because I think the one thing we can agree that we do not need more of in our politics is mindlessness, mindless partisanship. Because doomsday is here. This is not something that we need. And what occurred to me was that if one were so inclined, one could have made the same case or a similar case against the Obama administration. They could have said, "Look at the IRS, the Obama era IRS going after conservative organizations. Look at the Obama on the open mic." Telling Medvedev that he was willing to sort of in effect pull a con on the American electorate, and after he got reelected, he would adopt a missile defense policy more to Putin's liking. You could say, look at all the shady secrecy of the Iran deal, and how it was kept secret from our allies, and how Congress was kept out of it. You could say, look at the Obama administration going after journalists the Justice Department going after journalists that it didn't like James Rosen, and say, well, we have to punish this Democratic Party because they are normalizing and institutionalizing anti-democratic, dangerous norms that will blow up the future of rule of law in this country.
Well, we didn't a lot of do people it. Did say that, well, as yeah, well, it happens.
It was hysterical to those who did say
right.
it.
Again, so the provenance of this piece is they're saying we are bipartisan. We are not partisans. We are so incredibly not partisan. See, culturally, that's not true either of Wittes or of Jonathan Rauch. As it happens, they are nonpartisan in the sense that on certain specific issues of governance, they are nonpartisan, but they are both social liberals, as it happens. Now, so all things being equal in different ways. I mean, although Rauch casts himself as a Burkean conservative, he's gay. Wittes has a daughter who's trans. I mean, they have reasons to be more aligned, let's say, with the Democrats and the Republicans, and therefore to find, though they don't say this in the piece, to find a more, you know, comfortable home, finding it easier, let's say, than a social conservative whose main issue is opposing abortion and who may hate everything about the Trump administration but cannot countenance casting a vote for somebody who is pro-choice. So they don't have that problem. So therefore, you know, it's not that the piece is disingenuous, but it's incomplete because our politics is about more than just this. I think we at the table agree that Trump is a threat to certain types of norms. But the notion that you therefore contribute to the hastening of the destruction of norms by saying that nobody who thinks that on balance it's better for Trump to be in than out should be part of the conversation and must be destroyed, and therefore is, you know, willing to say, I would prefer the Republican Party be more oppositional toward Trump. That goes without saying, and that gave him a harder time, and that pushed back against his violation of norms. But the notion that, yeah, what we need is more mindlessness, and I think the other joke here in this rather interesting piece is the notion that there's anybody who will read it who will be on the other side of the argument, because everybody who will read it will simply confirm their priors, which is to say, this is so bad that you can now shut your brain off and just say every Republican is bad at every level, at every point, because that will maybe burn, because it's not going to change a single, everybody who reads that who's a Democrat is going to vote Democratic anyway.
But it will give them what they see as, you know, intellectual sanction to anti-intellectualism, which is dangerous, and which is actually
and we've seen that on the right too. Exactly. We see that with the kind of the bizarre American greatness notion that you can find an ideological frame in which to defend Trump. I am also, I think, tickled by the fact that I read these pieces, which don't describe a definable political reality, because right now in this country, Hillary Clinton got 2 million more votes than Trump. But right now in this country, the Republicans are the majority party at every level, but state, local, and federal. And the notion that what you do is then say boycott them, as opposed to, they're the majority party, but they're. But they're somewhat weak, and they can't get everything done that they want to get done. And the only way to handle this, it would be one thing if you could boycott them and they were the minority, and you could therefore destroy their power by simply denying them access to any power. And then because they can function pretty much the same way that the Obama functioned. I mean, Trump can decide at some point, I can't work with these Democrats. So he'll start using executive orders to declare, you know, to sort of create legislation out of the executive branch. What are they going to say? This is terrible. This is a violation of terrible norms. At least he's not doing that yet, you see. So the further they go into this, the more likely it is that they're going to push Trump into behaving even more recklessly and dangerously in their eyes. And for what? For this kind of onanistic satisfaction of saying, we have now had it with this. So everybody oppose everything at all times. It's not a serious argument. It's the opposite of a serious argument.
Right. It's yet another step in the sort of perfect mirroring of left right politics. This is their Flight 93 declaration.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good. That is so good. That is so good. So I think we're going to end on that point because Abe just made a wonderfully original observation.
It happens sometimes.
There you go. So, with hopes that Noah Rothman will be feeling better, and for Abe Greenwald and Saurabh Amari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.